This episode of the Vision Board Podcast is brought to you by Onnit. Why Onnit, you ask? Well, here's a word from Onnit's founder and CEO, Aubrey Marcus.
You know, Onnit is the company that has the tools to improve your performance. And in whatever area that you're looking for, we have something to do it. You know, it's like going to it's the Home Depot of house repair, but instead of house repair, it's body and mind repair. You know, and it's body and mind performance enhancement. It's going to that body shop and figuring out what tools that you can apply to help make your life better.
At the Vision Board Podcast, we only promote supplements that we use ourselves, and we only use the best. To give you insights, here's Johnny.
Yeah, guys, my two favorite that I take, one, Alpha Brain. Alpha Brain really helps improve mental focus and memory, and the second one I really swear by is Shroom Tech. Shroom Tech is designed to help your body with energy and cardiovascular endurance. What's your favorite, Tristan?
Johnny, the two that I love is the Warrior Buffalo Bars. I find these delicious snacks, and they're also perfect for when I'm on the road and also on the run. Also, I love the Dolce Whey. They're grass-fed whey protein isolate, perfect for my smoothies and also my post-workout shakes. Now, guys, check out the range at www.onnit.com, and please use code word VISIONBOARD for 10% off at checkout. Now, guys, enjoy the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 145 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell. Alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, Tristan Cannell? What's up, everybody? Hashtag 145.
Ken Shamrock.
Man. Yep.
Yeah, man. Follow up from Monday, man. I can't wait.
Yeah, Kenny Shamrock, man. Stoked to get him on. This is one of those pioneers of the sport. And what we like to do is sit down with these guys and get that story.
For sure, man. But, you know, I know that the Shamrock brothers are similar but also different. So it's going to be great for not only us but also the perspective of the audience to really just see the differences and kind of similarities, because it is quite an intriguing family story that they have.
Yeah, for sure, man. Could you imagine the dinner table when they were both fighting at Christmas?
Yeah, man.
Like having Frank and Ken there in the highest level of their sport, which just happens to be prize fighting. And to see how different and similar, like you said. And then also same last name, you know, but no bloodline. But that's interesting as well, young, to me.
Yeah, the similar childhood, you know, off the streets and the way their stepfather, you know, brought them up and things like that. It's quite an incredible tale.
Yeah, it's one of those perfect example of surround yourself around people doing great things. You'll be forced to evolve, and the Shamrock brothers are pretty much evidence of that.
For sure. Before we get Ken on the show, big thank you, guys. Thank you for leaving all the 5-star reviews, all the messages of support on social media and also via email. Really appreciate it. So get in touch anytime. We're at Vision Board Pod on Twitter, and what else has we got there?
Yeah, you know, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. Hit the Facebook up. We'd love for you to go to that page right now and like it. We'd love for you to share it with your friends, man. Just continue to support us, the Vision Board Podcast. We keep bringing it.
All right, guys. Well, exciting episode ahead. Here is Ken Shamrock. All right, our special guest is the world's most dangerous man, Ken Shamrock. Ken is a UFC inductee into the Hall of Fame and also a legend of professional wrestling. He's the founder of Lion's Den, a renowned fight school for the world's best fighters. While Ken is also led an incredible life journey, and he teaches people around the world. We welcome Ken Shamrock. Ken, welcome to the show, my man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Ken, what's up? It's Johnny. Thanks for stopping by the show. I've been watching you, man. I think the first show at least 20 years ago. My question comes, though. You had a fight recently, I think a little over a year ago with Hoist. Are you still training?
I'm doing maintenance. Not really, you know, I'm not getting in there and banging myself up at all, but I've always believed in a lifestyle, you know, so I still train just to stay in shape.
Yeah, and then for our fans listening at home who are, because Tristan and I are both coaches, what sort of things that you've had to adjust maybe in the weight room, outside, you know, not including the combat side, but your strength training? Talk about some adjustments going on.
Well, I would say that the biggest thing for me when, you reach a certain age is that you've got to give your time, yourself time to rest. I know a lot of guys make mistakes because they feel like they're not getting the results they used to get. So they start training more. And then all of a sudden they start seeing themselves shrink, like they're not keeping the size that they should keep.
Yeah.
And so they get freaked out and they start eating more and they start doing more stuff and whatever it is that they do to try to overcome that deficiency. Well, the bottom line is this, is it's rest. And I know it sounds like the simplest thing in the world and it can't be that, but it is. And so you have to, when you get older, allow your body to recover so it can grow.
Yeah, okay. So that's obviously sleep and that's training less. Are you eating better than you did when you were in your 20s as well, Ken?
No, not now.
We were talking to...
Now I'm eating the comfort foods.
You sound like my dad.
That's pop. We were talking to Frank Zane, bodybuilder. I think Frank's 74 now, and Frank still coaches and teaches, running businesses. And I asked him the question about, you know, what has allowed him to continually evolve later on, you know, in his 70s. And he said recovery. He said since the 70s, he would get in the float tank and he would meditate. Do you have any type of like, was that anything that you've been doing? Are you into any sort of like rest and recovery meditation sort of practices?
Well, it's not to the extreme of it being religious or anything like that, but I do believe that I did come to a point where I had to almost over rest. And in my mind, I was always doing something. And for me to step away and take that long off felt like that I wasn't working. And so it was real difficult for me to do it, but I realized if I didn't, then I wasn't going to get the results I wanted. So I would definitely make sure that when I would train one day really heavy with the weights, that I gave myself at least 48 hours of rest before I went and trained with weights again.
Yeah. Johnny brought up before your fight with Royce Gracie. In terms of your future fighting, do you still have ambitions in that area, Ken?
Oh, I do, of course. I mean, I think I've pretty much made it very clear that, you know, it's in my DNA. It's it's not something that it's easily for me to walk away from. So I'm not going to walk away from it. I'm going to continue to stay where I am. I will always have my door open for the right fight.
Yeah.
I tried to explain this early in my career. Not early in my career, but earlier in when I was fighting in my 40s, when I came back to fight Tito, and on past that, is I tried to explain to the fans when they started jumping on me and saying, you should retire, you're too old, do this and that. And I tried to explain to them, like, it's not like I did this, like, for a job, and that when my time's up, I want to go and retire, go fishing and camping and whatever people do when they retire. I did this because it's something I love doing. And so when it was time for me to retire, I retired from the rankings of MMA world. I wasn't putting myself in a position to fight the top fighters. I was, besides Tito, that was something that I had to do in order to help build up MMA. Mm. But really, I put myself in a position to do it because I loved it. Yeah. So I made sure I matched myself up with the right fighters so that I could continue to train and get in the ring and fight and have fun safely without fighting some 22-year-old stud, which was like when I was 40-something years old, I was fighting Tito.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but that was a different situation because Dana came to me and asked, hey, you know, we're dying. You know, we need to keep to we're going to close.
Yep.
And we don't do something. And so it was really a desire for me to keep MMA going. And once I fought Tito, then I started going out and fighting fights that made sense to the fans, sense to me, and have fun with it. So that's why I say to you, I'll never retire. And if the right fight comes around, you know, like, for instance, Royce Gracie comes back and does the right thing instead of walking off saying that, you know, yeah, he won the fight, you know, which is embarrassing to myself and MMA, period, then I would fight again. Absolutely.
Ken, I think it was, I think it was 1997. I was in high school. My buddies and I were sophomores. We started watching MMA when we had a, you would order the whole, it wasn't streamed live on pay-per-view, and it would be like 7 hours of just fights. And you were, that's when I first started watching you. And you were, of all the, like, guys listening at home, this is in the days of, like, no weight classes, barely any rules, and you had to fight multiple times in that same night. Nothing like the UFC today. What was it? I remember you walking in, and, you know, the presence you had, your body, your build, your makeup. What was it like staring down the dude in the gi, I'm referencing Royce Gracie, initially before you fought him that first time, the mindset? And then when did it switch on when you were in battle that you were like, oh, shit, this guy's something different?
Yeah, I tell you, when I had defended my title over in Japan 3 days prior to the event happening. And, of course, I'm saying it's not going to happen. Because, you know, if you remember back in them days, there's no such thing. You only saw that stuff in the movies, right? Yeah. It just didn't seem like, because it was street fights, basically. And you just thought to yourself, there's no way that they're going to allow this to happen. And so I end up doing my fight. I defend my title. I knock out my opponent with the knee.
Hold on.
I fly to Denver, Colorado, 3 days prior to the event, thinking it's not going to happen. And if it does, they're going to go, okay, guys, this is how it's going to go. Mm. Well, all the way up to the fight, I'm waiting for that meeting. And so a meeting happens. But when the meeting happens, they confirm that this is no holds barred, anything goes. Wow. And so I started to get really jazzed because, I mean, I grew up that way. I mean, I grew up in juvenile hall and fighting in the street and in a group home until I was 18. And, you know, you learn how to defend yourself and fight for things, you know. And so for me to go in there and fight somebody with not, you don't have to worry about getting jumped, shot, or stabbed. That was like, this is game on.
Yeah.
And so right up to the fight, well, and I remembered soon, probably, I don't know, maybe the night before, if I can remember correctly. It was the night before. And I believe it was Art Davies. I can't be correct, too sure on that. But I remember Art Davies came to me and he said, hey, this is how it's going to go. You can't wear your shoes. And I remember thinking to myself, what are you talking about? You can't wear your shoes. Because remember, I was fighting in Japan. We wore wrestling shoes.
Was that Pancrase?
I'd always wore shoes. I'd never fought without shoes. So I said, okay, no problem. I want to beat all these guys anyways. Mm-hmm. So the next day, I go in there. I remember we got to go in the ring and kind of feel it out a little bit. It was like being on ice. I mean, it was because I hadn't been used to that, right? Mm. So it was really slippery. And so I thought to myself, this is going to be challenging. But I'll still take him down, no problem. So I go into my first fight. And if you watch that, I'm slipping all over the place. I had to tight waist him and just basically try to sweep him down. Mm. And once I got there, I just finished him. And I remember going in against Hoist. I went from that fight to my locker room, because I brought three different colors of shorts I was going to change into. Yep. I go to my locker room. Just as I get there, they say, you're up. Didn't even have a chance to change, get a drink of water. Didn't even go into my locker room. They blocked me from going to my locker room and said, you're up again. Nice. So Hoist had about 20, 25 minutes of rest. I had zero rest.
Oh, wow.
Went right in and fight him. I go to take him down. I'm slipping all over the place. Mm. And here's the thing that it dawned on me, right? Mm. I took him down, we were rolling all over, and I remember I sat back for a leg lock like I did against Patrick Smith. And as I was going to get it, my arm was trapped in his gi, like he wrapped it around.
Yep.
So as I sat, I pulled him on top of me. So I recognized that, and I went to spin out. Well, as I spun out, I felt this gi wrap around my throat, and he started choking me with it, and I was like, and literally, it was only about 5 seconds, right? Yeah. Mm. What was going through my head was like, he's choking me. I went to grab the arm. There's no arm. And I was like, he's choking me with his gi. It's like, that's a weapon. I was like, and this is like 5 seconds, right?
Yeah.
So I tap. The referee doesn't see it. And I remember I'm sitting there on my knees looking up. The referee's going, you tapped. The voice going, you tapped, you tapped, you tapped. And the referee's going, fight, fight, fight. And I remember looking up at him, and I said, yeah, I tapped. I look back on that fight and I kept saying to myself, why is it they took my shoes away? Because they said it was a weapon. It was supposed to be no holds barred, anything goes. Mm. They took my shoes away but didn't take his gi away. And here's the other thing. I want you guys to pay attention to this. This is why I knew I had him. This is why I knew he was worried about me. Because every fight he's ever been in, if somebody had a question about whether or not they tapped or didn't tap, he said, you want to go again.
Yeah.
Gave me that opportunity. He said, you tapped. He never said, okay, you want to go again? Yeah. He never said that. So that's when I knew I had him going into the next fight, which the next fight I was able to put a beating on him.
Yeah. Did you know who Royce Gracie was before you fought him the first time?
I didn't, you know. I mean, I made a joke about when he was walking around that some guy's wearing pajamas, you know, and he was a small guy. We were actually the two smallest guys in the tournament.
Yeah.
And so I just didn't think anything of him. But I tell you, you know, even though the things that I thought that those guys did in my fight to try to lean things their way, there's no doubt the guy's got skill and that he's a fabulous fighter. There's no doubt at all.
Yeah. Ken, where'd you learn your grappling? I know the Lion's Den is synonymous in the infancy of MMA. It's like a cathedral. But was it jiu-jitsu or was it submission grappling? Share some insights on like maybe who your coaches were and how you polished your game up before you became, you know, on the national scene, international scene.
Well, I think my toughness and toughness and my scrappiness came up from the way I was brought up. I was brought up in group homes and juvenile halls, so that's where I got my scrappiness and my toughness. I wrestled everywhere I went. I was always wrestling. And then I did also do some boxing. When I was in the group home, I did some boxing there. So I had some foundation there. But really when I started getting polished was when I went to Japan. Okay. And when I first signed with them, I would stay in Japan and I would train over there in the dojo. And so I did that for about 2.5 years of strict training. And it was like I said, if you saw my skill sets, I fought Hoist and I had 2.5 years of experience in that world of MMA or no holds barred. And he had, 22 years under his belt, plus, you know, 40 years with his family.
Yeah.
And I was able to handle him. So the intense training that I got in those 2.5 years was second to none.
Yeah, so it's written that, you know, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu came from Japan. Was this the form of – were you doing that form in Japan for the 2.5 years?
No, actually, this was a Carl Gotch catch wrestling type submissions. And what that was set up for was actually to defend the Gracie jiu-jitsu. Most people don't know this, but and that's why you don't see it a lot in these tournaments is because the jiu-jitsu people don't want this catch wrestling and leg locks in because – if you watch out jiu-jitsu and the way that they attack their submissions off their back is they throw their legs around your waist.
Yeah.
And then they work from there. Well, with the catch wrestling and the leg submissions, that's the entrance into leg submissions. So that's why when I fought Hoist, he was having a hard time trying to attack me because if he opens his legs up too much, then I'm going to submit him with a leg lock. Yeah. So it's really the leg locks are actually the defense to the guard.
All right.
How much more advanced was the training in Japan compared to what you were receiving in America?
Well, I don't think it was as advanced. I just think it was the amount of time you spent. Over there, we spent all day in the gym, in the dojo, you know, from morning till in the afternoon, and then we went home and slept and we did it again.
Was it very spiritual? Was it like, was that part of it as well, apart from the physical side?
No, it was not. As far as I could tell, there was none of that bowing and any of that stuff. It was just hardcore.
Okay. Yeah,
banging. So I want to talk about your when you got to the WWF, it was almost like, because I had already known who you were, you know, from fighting MMA, it was almost like you were culminated, like WWF was built for you and your persona. How much of that, your character, what were you putting on and how much, like, was it difficult? It seemed pretty easy.
Yeah, you know, and the reason why it was is because I didn't go away from who I was. Yeah. I just stayed with me. I was frustrated. I was angry, and I just let it out. And even in my ring work, I kept the same intensity. You know, obviously I didn't go in and just try to hurt somebody, but I definitely made guys work when they worked with me. There was no, it wasn't like they were going to grab a hold and rest, man. When they worked with me, they better be in shape.
Yeah. Did, when you first arrived, did someone take you under their wings and show you the ropes in terms of, because it's a big change from going from professional fighting to professional wrestling.
Yeah, they did. I tell you, Bret Hart was a big, big reason why I was able to be very successful. You know, he took me under his wing. I went to Canada. I worked with him before my match with Vader. And that's where I got that idea to just be me. Don't change. Don't try to be something. Don't be a character. Your character is already good. Be you. So I did.
What was that like during the interview that's really well documented, when they were doing that little piece on mixed martial arts and fighting, and then they had the piece on you, and they gave you the man's world's most dangerous man. Was that something that, because it stuck with you, and it suits, and it's synonymous with Ken Shamrock, but was that literally given to you, or was it something that you had told them?
Yeah, I think that anytime anybody has a nickname, if you name yourself, it don't count.
Yeah, right.
For me, it really did come from a place where they were actually doing this special. I don't know which one, ABC or NBC, one of those big networks was doing the special on the world's most dangerous animal, world's most dangerous food, world's most dangerous place, you know, all these dangerous things. And then they had the one of the world's most dangerous man. And I know they had gone through a bunch of different people, you know, a lot of guys, you know, that had been through the gamut all over the world. And because of what I was doing at the time, and because it seemed like it was so barbaric to people that they end up naming me that person, and they came and did a special on me. And I was afraid of it because of all the negativity we were getting by doing that MMA or the No Holds Barred at that time. But when they did a great piece on me. They showed me who I was as a person, as a father, as a family man. And it really helped actually show people that, you know, the people that are doing this No Holds Barred are no different than you and your neighbors. We're just as you. We just do something different for work.
Yeah. Actually, that's actually an interesting point, because we spoke to your brother a few weeks ago, and he spoke about kind of building a brand. And realistically, yourself and him were two of the best at building a brand. A lot of even today, the pioneers. UFC guys still don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
So was that something that was intentional? And just talk to us a little bit about building business and branding.
Yeah, it was intentional. You know, I think that when you start getting into that world of boxing or pro wrestling or MMA or even football, or, you know, you gotta learn from the guys that have been there before. And I rubbed shoulders with a lot of NFL players. There was a strength trainer named Kim Woods, who was a strength trainer for the Bengals. You know, I got a lot of insight on how those guys had done things, especially when their career is over. Who are you as a person? If you allow them, and pro wrestling is the biggest one to do that, they'll take your character and they own it. And then when you're done, you can't do anything anymore with that character.
Yeah.
I own my character, so I didn't allow them to take that. And I own my character in the MMA world, and then also whatever else I've done. I've always built a brand because I knew that whenever I was done actually competing, I knew that I had to still keep moving on and doing the other business opportunities. And I needed to make sure that the brand that I had built during that time, that nobody else owned but me. And so I made sure in all my contracts and everything I'd done, I carved that out. But nowadays, it's almost like guys don't get a shot at doing the type of things they want to do unless they give up their name and that brand.
Yeah. Do you think this was starting to be, flourished as a young boy going through all that adversity, being able to maneuver in and out of those homes you're talking about, developing savviness, developing wittiness? Was this something that started there?
Well, you know, I don't have the ability to sit down in a conference room and be able to understand a lot of the lingo. I do now. But to be able to understand a lot of the lingo at the time and all the things that were going on. But the one thing I learned from the street and growing up is I always smelled a rat. And I always knew when something was right. When things were being put together, I knew that there was something wrong. And so after a while, I ended up bringing people alongside of me to be able to help me understand why that I was seeing those things. And it's true, because a lot of times when you go in there, you know, you're talking about merchandise sales, you're talking about international sales, you're talking about the gate, you're talking about pay-per-view numbers. There's different ways, international pay-per-view, there's domestic pay-per-view, there's all these things that, and you talk about sales too, you're talking about different ways of sales. And there's so many things that goes along with the royalties and the pay, that when you go in to negotiate a fair deal for yourself in a fight, because especially if you're in the main event, that's what they're going to see. So you need to be able to sit down and be able to negotiate a fair price, knowing all the stuff that's involved. And if you don't understand how much stuff's involved, you can't really negotiate a fair price for yourself, because you don't understand all the numbers that are coming in.
Yeah. Did anyone mentor you on the business side of things, Ken?
No, I picked it up basically just asking questions and here and there. Because
yeah.
Even if you have an agent, they're still foreign. You don't know whether or not they're doing you right.
Yeah.
And a lot of times there's some that didn't do me right, but I felt there was something wrong, and I ended up digging in and searching and finding out there was, by asking questions. And I really do believe a lot of people that don't understand that but have a sense of their something's not right, you got to follow that instinct, because most of the time, you're probably...
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
So I lived in Vegas for 2 years before I moved down here to Australia, and then we would go up to Trekkie, like Tahoe area. And my question is, you're a Reno guy. You still live there?
Yes, in fact, I'm here now. Yeah, I live North Reno.
Yeah, yeah. And you've always been there. Like, what's it about Reno that keeps you there?
One is I love to be able to have the four seasons. I'm not a guy that wants to be warm all the time. I love storms. I love the snow. I love when it's just thundering, right? But then also, too, I get tired of it, and I want the spring. You know, I want it to be nice. I love camping. I don't hunt, but I like to camp. I love to do outdoor sports. And I love winter sports. So for me, it's the perfect place, because we call it the biggest little city in the world, because we have the kind of the big city atmosphere. But 20 minutes outside the city, you're camping. You're riding horses. You're doing whatever you want. Yeah. So for me, it's a perfect area.
Did you ever live in L.A.?
No.
You seem like an L.A. guy, man.
Vegas. I visited L.A. I visited all the big cities in the world, and I always said it's fun to go there, but I don't want to live there.
Awesome. Yeah. Did you raise your children in Reno?
I did, yes. I have 7 kids and 13 grandbabies.
Wow. That's awesome, man. Congrats on that.
What I want to ask you about that, just a segue before Johnny brought up adversity from your own childhood, what are the things that you try to instill in your own children and your grandchildren now?
Well, as my kids were growing up, the one thing I wanted to tell them was, and I tried to raise them in that way, is that, you know, you're an individual, you're your own person, but the only thing that you really can call yours is your word, your honesty, your integrity, everything that you are when you're growing up, that honesty and truthfulness, all that stuff. As you grow, that's the only thing in this world that you can control is you and what you want to be. So when you grow up, man, when everybody asks you, no matter how hard it is, you tell the truth and you be honest, because it'll always work its way out. And then the next thing was, it was really another thing I instilled in, because of what I did, was you don't ever put your hands on anybody. Yeah. And especially if a woman even puts her hands on you, you do not put your hands on a woman at all. And I instilled that into them, those two things into them. And I feel like those things right there would everything else would fall in place if they honor those things, and it has. And my kids are awesome. Mm. They've all grown up. They got kids of their own. They're doing great. They have good work ethic, and they're honest.
How many sons do you have?
I have three kids. Three men. I don't want to call them boys.
Yeah.
Three men and four girls. Four women.
Four women.
Ken, of the three, well, of the seven, I guess. Was there one of them, or were there two of them that were like really drawn into the fighting? Because you'd have to think, your dad being a superhero, one of them would want to follow in those footsteps. And if there was, what did you tell him?
Yeah, the fact is, I had two of them. Ryan and Sean both fought. They both done very well. Ryan, his second fight, because back when he did it, there was no amateur. So he fought a guy from England who was number five in the world, and it was his second fight.
Yeah.
He broke his hand. He's beating the guy. He won the first round, and he broke his hand, and they had to stop the fight. But he was winning, so he was really good. Well, then he got a girl pregnant, and so he decided that he needed to be a father and take care of that first. So he stepped away, and he's a great dad. He's a good man. And so he's not really doing that now.
Yeah.
And my other son, Sean, who's only he's 22. He was good. He fought a couple. He's 2-1.
Mm.
The one fight he lost was a championship fight in his third fight. Wow. As an amateur. He fought a guy for the title and lost the decision. But he was 2-1. And he's done well. But he's got a girl now. They're getting married in October.
Oh, wow.
And so he's put his on the back burner, so he's not doing it. And my other one, Connor, who's my middle oldest boy, he's got natural talent. He's like me, where he can kick and punch, and he's just naturally strong, and he's good.
Yeah.
But he's not violent. He doesn't want to hit somebody. So they've asked me. I don't push it.
Mm.
And I'll train. I told them I'll train you guys if you want to pursue it. But they've asked my thoughts on it. And I said, you know, the way that the MMA world is now, is that I don't like it, because you have to do so much to get there. And then when you do get there, you're not making enough to retire on.
Yeah.
Especially if you got a family and you want to raise a family, I think you're wasting your time. I mean, maybe if you were 17 and 8, 19, 20 years old and you wanted to pursue it, I think, yeah. But I think now that you guys are in your 20, 22, 25, and 27, it's a little bit late for that, because even if you do make it there and you do get a big fight, you're not getting paid enough to be able to say, hey, man, I can retire.
Yeah.
They're not paying you enough money when you do make it. So I can't see my kids trying to make that a career. Because it's like rolling the dice to stay healthy and get there. And if you do, and you do fight a couple times and win, you're not making enough money to step away and say, I'm retired.
Do you still watch the sport?
I don't. I mean, I hear about it, I follow it, but I don't watch it.
Okay. Yeah.
Ken, just on fighting, what did you find harder, becoming the world champ or retaining your title?
Retaining it, definitely. I think, and I think a lot of fighters will tell you this, if they're being honest, when you get there, you're hungry, and you got so much to work for, right? And there's no pressure, right?
Yeah.
Because you're going after something. Once you get it, it's like being a superhero, like you said. You're just a superhero, and everybody believes you can't be beat. So when somebody comes up, now you're the favorite, and they're the underdog. And so now, you fight not to lose, because there's so much pressure for you to win.
Yeah.
You watch St. Pierre do it. You watch a lot of other people do it, where they didn't use the skills that got them there. They just fought enough to win, just to make sure they kept the strap around their belt. And it's a normal thing to happen, because there's so much pressure on you to win. So I think it's harder to retain the belt, because now that you've got it, you're like the superhero, and when people don't believe you can be beat.
Yeah, you mentioned George and GSP. His style, he took a lot of heat for that, how he would just grind you out and grapple you to the ground, but just do enough to get the W. So you take a guy like that, and then, you know, there's a young kid right now, I think he's 23, named Yair Rodriguez, and he's a lighter fighter. And he's like, you watch him, and it's almost like watching an artist, how creative he is with his kicks and how he's able to ad-lib movements. And what I wanted to ask you is, you know, where the sport started when you were building it up and where it is today, and I know you're not watching it a lot now, where do you see it going in the future?
Well, you know, I think right now, if the growth of the sport, I believe now has to be, I think, and if they're, to separate the fighters, right, to guys that are doing everything what they're doing now. Mm. Now I believe they've got to start getting in the leg locks, because that to me is the only the discipline that is being left out that separates great fighters. Because I think right now they're keeping it out of the amateur ranks, because you can't do leg locks in the amateur ranks. So when they get to be a pro, nobody's really using them because they haven't practiced them.
Yeah.
But if they allow that to happen, and I think that has to be the next step, they start allowing that to happen, then you're going to see another level of greatness. Because now when you start using that guard, people have to watch out, because now guys can start submitting you from the guard.
Are you familiar with John Donahar? Have you heard it?
No.
He's a heel hook specialist, and you know, I think his gym's in Milwaukee, but that's their thing, is you know, they go for the single leg and they go straight for the heel hooks. And so I didn't know this about the amateur, like you said. I didn't know that you weren't allowed to do leg locks there. Is that to protect obviously the health, the knee, all that good stuff? And then if it is, isn't it holding the sport back in terms of evolving?
It's not because they want to make it safer. It's because all the people that are putting these on are all jiu-jitsu specialists. They're all black belts.
Okay.
And they don't want to look bad when they say, well, how do you defend this and how do you defend that, when they don't know how. It is a way to defeat someone putting you in the guard. You're basically giving them your legs.
Yep.
They don't want that. That's why it was done. Because if you're telling me a knee to the head or an elbow to the head is not as dangerous or is less dangerous than a heel hook, you're crazy.
Yeah.
This is controversy, man. Or yeah, like even when you look at a head kick, like, because you're not allowed to hit in the back of the head, but that head kick loops around, and when you get knocked out, it's because it's hit in the back of the head. And like the whole 12 to 6 elbow thing, like how's that?
Yeah, I just don't get it when they talk about heel hooks and leg locks being dangerous. Yeah, you break a bone, but how is that death defying? How is that like dangerous? Give me a break. What a punch, an elbow, a knee, a kick. You're telling me those aren't dangerous? More dangerous than a heel hook?
Shit, I think they're going to start giving participation points. Hopefully not.
Right.
Could you imagine? Good job, buddy. Here you go. Yeah, here you go.
Hey, Ken, when you're putting people in the locks when you were professional wrestling, was there something, like, did you maybe go overboard one day? Do you have any stories about that or anything like that?
No, you know, I wanted to make sure that when people talk about Ken Shamrock, they talked about the greatness and they talked about the professionalism. You know, even like when I fought Dan Severn back in Detroit, when they took the rules and they changed him, I went in there and I fought by the rules, even though it called a fight. But I fought by the rules. That has been important to me from day one, because that's what saved my life, was being able to take something with all my frustration and anger and be able to put it into something that I could do whatever I want as long as I stay within the rules. So to me, it was important to make sure that that's what happened, that I fought within the rules and that people remembered me, that I was one, determined, and that I was a professionalism.
Yeah. In my notes right here, I have a question that says legacy, but I'd rather you answered it for me. I'd rather ask you the question describing your style. If you had to pick one word when you're at your prime, you had the belt, what one word would you use to describe your style?
Relentless.
Attaboy.
That's what I was thinking.
Relentless.
Yeah. All right, Ken, we've hit the personality part of the interview. Johnny's got the first question.
Yeah, first question. Ken Shamrock, three of your best friends are sitting at a table and you're not in the room. What sort of things are they saying about you?
My best friends?
Yeah. Yes.
Not family.
No, closest friends.
Closest friends would have to probably say, I can't put it into words, but what do you call when someone's always there for you?
Dependable.
Dependable. Well, yeah, but also when you got somebody, whenever you're in
trouble, loyal.
And they think about who they're going to call.
Loyal, dependable, reliable.
Yeah, loyal.
Reliable.
Loyal, that's it.
That's it.
Loyal.
Awesome.
All right. What was the biggest thing that you learned from two people, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, and Owen Hart?
Say that again.
What was the biggest thing that you took away from The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, and Owen Hart?
Well, I would say both of them, the same thing was their integrity and their honesty and their work ethic.
Ken, we use this platform to showcase people like yourself to give our fans insights and words of encouragement. So the question comes from adversity. For all of our fans listening at home who are maybe struggling with some adversity, could you leave them with a little bit of advice or insights on how to overcome it?
Yeah, you know, and I think I can speak pretty well to this because I've done, I mean, even as I made it, I had adversity and things hit you all the time. And the thing I could say is just you got to trust the process. I mean, if there's one thing that I've learned is that there are always things that are going to happen. You're always going to be, no matter how successful you become, you're always going to run into things that are going to happen. And life is like mountains and valleys. You're no matter what happens, you're going to be in those valleys and it's going to be rough times. But it's always going to turn good somewhere along the line. So always make sure that you trust the process. Trust the process, because if you start doing other things to try to force it, you're usually going to do things that aren't good, and you're going to get yourself in trouble, and you're going to get behind in a bad way. And then when that process starts to turn around and be good for you, you're not in a position to be able to take advantage of it. So put yourself in a good position by trusting the process.
Excellent. Wise words. All right, final question. Ken, you're going to be hosting a private dinner party. You've got 5 invites. It can be anyone dead or alive. Only rule is no family or friends. Who are you inviting?
Oh, man, I don't think I've got that many people. My family is so big. I would have to say people that were important to me all the way through my fighting career and coming up. We'd have to say Guy Mazger, Jerry Bolander, Vernon White, Pete Williams, and of course, even after all the stuff that goes on, I would have to say there's a good friend of mine, JT Warsh, and also a guy that I depend on all the time that is, you know, money for me, is Des Woodruff.
Awesome, Ken Shamrock.
Well, Ken, the fans, before we let you go, everyone get following Ken, www.kenshamrock.com. Twitter is at ShamrockKen. On Facebook, he's the world's dangerous man. Just before I let you go as well, Ken, you're going to be speaking at the Collision Conference, correct? Coming up?
Yes.
Maybe tell the audience out there just a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, talk a little bit about trusting the process, you know, putting yourself in a good position through the times that you're struggling and not making bad decisions to put you behind so you're able to take advantage when those good times come around. And this is one of those things where, you know, I was I was out of fighting, not retired or anything, but just, you know, I wasn't in that world anymore. And so I had to rebrand myself and start moving in the right direction. And so I wanted to start doing things, becoming business owners and working in the business world. So I started infusing myself into these different conferences, young entrepreneur conferences, and this one is coming up. And so I started doing that so that people can look at me and see that, hey, Ken Shamrock, wow, he's wearing a suit and tie. He's putting himself in the position. He's surrounding himself with people that are successful in that business world. Hmm. And so since I've done that, now we're going to this big conference in New Orleans. It's one of the bigger ones. I have a watch. We call it wrist tops or wearables. It's the future where the wrist tops, which the people call watches, that are on your wrist now become your laptop and your cell phone. You don't have to carry those around with you. You put the wrist top on and you got it. So these things are the newest things coming out, and I'm involved in it. It's called Grok Global Technologies, and that's what we're going down to speak on. And of course, this thing called CE3, which is Celebrity Entrepreneur, we put people together to try to help them, you know, be able to take their popularity and be able to do what me and my business partner did, was be able to monetize their celebrity status into an equity ownership of these different businesses. Mm-hmm. So we're turning that into a place that we can solve a problem that's out there. And so that's something we'll also be talking about there also. So that's kind of where I was talking about, you know, when you're putting yourself and making sure that you, you know, trust the process and not make mistakes along the way because you feel like you're stressed and you need to reach for things. Trust the process, allow things to happen, surround you with people and things that are going to help you go in the direction that you want to go. And so in Chicago next week, man, we'll be speaking in front. Well, there's going to be, I think they're talking about 20 to 30,000 people Ooh. In attendance at this place. Wow. So we're going to have a big audience. It's one of the biggest tech conventions, I think, in the United States. So you're going to see Ken Shamrock in some bigger and better things coming up.
Yeah, man. Hey, I had your figurine when I was a kid, man. I really appreciate you stopping by the show and doing this with us.
Hey, appreciate you guys, man. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Ken. It was a pleasure, my man.
All right. God bless.
Peace.
Johnny, Kenny Shamrock.
Dude, the energy that guy has, man, you could feel it resonating through the screen.
That was one of my favorite athlete interviews in terms of that same day, guys, we interviewed George Foreman as well, and that was a real highlight for myself and Johnny. But yeah, Ken really blew us away.
Yeah, for sure, man. It's not every day, you know, this is becoming a cliche, but it's not every day that you and I get to sit down with a guy that I used to think was a superhero. Mm. You know what I'm saying? He was in the WWF, I had his figurine. And to hear his still passion for life, his intensity, his insights, how he lives, you get the clear picture of why he was able to get to the top of his game.
Yeah, it's going to be a great recap when we talk about both the relationship with him and brother. I can't wait for Friday because it's going to be some great chat that we're going to have on that day because realistically, he blew me away in terms of I thought he was just a fighter.
That's right. Not just fighting, man. He's mindset, business.
But just how he like intertwines it, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, he's a fighter, but he's a fighter not just in the cage, he's a fighter at business, at life.
Yeah, he gives you everything he has, man. Yeah, he brings, right, you can feel that intensity coming through the screen. He's one of those guys that's selfless with the energy. He gives you what he has.
Yeah, I really enjoy that one. So guys, check it out, Friday recap. If you're just jumping on the show for the first time this week, just remember, go back. Frank, his brother, was on Monday, so it's another great one. It's a great way to kind of see the similarities and differences between two brothers. So first time on the Vision Ball podcast, we've had two brothers representing.
For sure, man. And also fans of MMA will give you, newer fans of MMA, give you some insights on the evolution of the sport. Mm. Man, these guys were part of that movement, and where it is today, you know, the UFC has, you know, give them thanks.
Yeah, for sure. All right, guys, so tune in. Before that, just remember to share it with your family and friends if you haven't yet. Subscribe via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and please leave us a 5-star review.
Couldn't say it any better, Tristan Cano.
All right, my man, I will see you on Friday for another great show.
Yes, sir.
Peace.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.